Today's episode is brought to you by Freed Hardeman University. Are you a local minister, and these days do you feel like you refer more and more members of your congregation to an outside agency or counselor? Do you feel like you would like to have the tools to be able to help some of those folks right there in your own office? Well, why don't you think about enrolling in the Master of Arts in Pastoral Care and Counseling program at Freed Hardeman University? This degree will give you the psychological and spiritual expertise to provide care and counseling from within your ministry context. You'll take courses in things like grief counseling, premarital counseling, suffering and the human condition, psychopathology, and more. Maybe you have questions or maybe you have doubts about whether you can handle grad school. Well, Freed Hardeman can help, whether you're wondering about the cost or the time it will take to earn your master's degree. Here's a little good news to encourage you to keep exploring. You can complete the entire program online. And yes, scholarships are available even for you. So if you're a minister looking for more ways to care for the members of your congregation and their neighbors, or you know a minister like that, why not have a look at the Master of Arts in Pastoral Care and Counseling at Freed Hardeman University? Go to fhu.edu/chronicle to learn more. That's fhu.edu/chronicle, or click the link in the show notes. Freed Hardeman University, Master of Pastoral Care and Counseling, fhu.edu/chronicle. Now, on with the show.
Welcome to the Christian Chronicle podcast. We're bringing you the stories that are shaping Church of Christ congregations and members around the world. Here's our host, B.T. Irwin.
Family and friends, neighbors, and most of all, strangers, welcome to the Christian Chronicle podcast. May what you are about to hear bless you and honor God. This time, we've got some real live collegiate national champions with us. They'll tell you what it took to claim their spot at the top of their sport while staying true to Jesus Christ. We're also going to Turkey. Well, the Christian Chronicle's Audrey Jackson went to Turkey, and she brought back news about how Christians in that country are recovering from the earthquakes that destroyed so many lives a year ago. How might God be working among them to bring new life from the rubble? But first, here in the United States, immigration may be the most important and urgent issue of our time. Here's my personal observation. Americans on the left, in the middle, and on the right all agree the immigration law and the immigration system in the United States is failing everyone, both citizens and immigrants alike. Surely it is possible to solve some of those problems, but the political incentives seem to reward politicians who fight and obstruct each other rather than find ways to get things done. Meanwhile, in churches across the United States, Christians are wrestling with themselves. On one hand, the Bible is emphatic that the people of God should lavish aliens, immigrants, and outsiders with the same hospitality that they would give to family, friends, and the native-born. Indeed, this was the hallmark of early Christianity in the first three centuries. On the other hand, some would question whether it is right to take bread out of the mouths of their own children and give it to others. Is it not also godly and good to protect and provide for one's own community and home? I mean, when the oxygen mask falls from the ceiling, do the flight attendants not say to put it on yourself first and then help others? Well, we're not here to go over the points and counterpoints of the immigration debate in the United States, but we do have someone here today who can give us some new insight into what Christians are thinking about it and how that is affecting them and their congregations. Scott McConnell is executive director of Lifeway Research in Nashville, Tennessee, and they recently released a report on evangelical attitudes on immigration and immigration policy in the United States. Now, before we go on, yes, I know that a lot, maybe most folks in the Church of Christ community, do not consider themselves to be evangelical. That's okay. I'm not saying that you are. But outside research organizations find enough characteristics about us that we share in common with evangelicals that they put us in the evangelical category when doing research like what we'll hear about today. So, Scott, welcome back. It's your second time on the show. Thanks for coming back to be with us today.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, let's start with the big picture. First of all, how do you define evangelical for the purpose of your survey? And then how many evangelicals did you survey? And what did you want to find out from them on this particular report?
Yeah, there's at least three different ways you can define evangelicals. And we actually used two of them on this survey. So we surveyed just over 1,000 Americans, and they qualified if they identified themselves as an evangelical. But before we asked that question and actually used the word, we also asked four belief questions. Mm-hmm. And if they strongly agreed with those four beliefs, we categorized them as having evangelical beliefs, and they qualified for the survey as well.
Yeah. What were those four beliefs?
Believing that the Bible is the highest authority for what you believe. Saying it's very important for me personally to encourage non-Christians to trust Jesus Christ as their Savior. Strongly agreeing that Jesus Christ's death on the cross is the only sacrifice that can remove the penalty of my sin. And strongly agreeing that only those who trust in Jesus Christ alone as their Savior receive God's free gift of eternal salvation.
So what did you find out when you, what did you want to find out when you decided to do this study?
This is actually the third time we've done this study, but really trying to understand where evangelicals are at. You know, our culture has for a long time had a lot of different beliefs about immigration, and increasingly politicians are talking about immigration and using it kind of for leverage for what they're trying to promote. And so trying to understand, you know, before people put words into the mouths of a group that does show up on some political polling categories, what do the people actually believe? First of all, one of the key elements here is that most evangelicals are ready for change. The status quo is not serving anyone well right now. And so 77% of them say it's important for them personally that Congress pass significant new legislation on immigration. 9 out of 10 say it should protect the unity of the immediate family. Sometimes that's very hard to do if only a child shows up at the border. Right. But as a principle, that's something we should be striving for. Respecting the rule of law, guaranteeing the security of our national borders, ensuring fairness to taxpayers, and one that does not hit 90%, but 3/4 of evangelicals believe that those changes, that legislation should establish a path towards citizenship. For those who do not have legal status today. Those are some general principles that there's been agreement really since 2015 when we first asked some of these questions. Evangelicals are very supportive of some of those broad directions. And sometimes we get caught up in a narrative that's oversimplified about whose fault it is rather than actually saying, well, what are we actually trying to accomplish here?
So one of the things I picked up from skimming the survey is that it seems that evangelicals who responded, they're not disagreeable toward each other on this, but it seems like they're trying to hold on to two what seem like opposing poles. So everything you just mentioned, even the path to citizenship, and yet wanting a change in policy because there seems to be a consensus that there's a crisis of some kind with immigration. So would you say that's accurate, that evangelicals are kind of trying to hold on to both ends of this issue at the same time?
I would say there's more than just two ends to it. It's a complicated issue. And sometimes some of the individual things that are causing problems in our immigration system, it's pretty obvious what the solution would be, and yet it gets rolled up into some of the bigger arguments and the progress doesn't get made. So I would point to one question, and this question will kind of show us two tensions. We gave a statement to the respondents. Christians have a responsibility to care sacrificially for refugees and other foreigners. And 7 out of 10 say yes. Christians have that responsibility. And so that's implying that care, as in love, we should be definitely compassionate toward those who are coming to our country. But the sacrificially word kind of implies that financially it could impact us.
Yes.
So one of the tensions that ties to is the very next question we asked was, Christians have a responsibility to assist immigrants, even if they're here illegally. So one of the tensions is legal versus illegal, documented versus undocumented. Still, a majority of Christians agree that we have a responsibility to assist, even if someone is here illegally. And but it's just 55%. So it drops a very noticeable 15% from the 70% who said we should be caring sacrificially. The other tension that caring sacrificially kind of ties to was the opening question on our survey that really kind of captured just an emotional reaction of people. We gave nine or eight statements and said, you know, which of these reflect your beliefs about the number of immigrants coming to our country? Number one answer which people were really spread out on their answers. So it was just 50%, but number one answer was they are a drain on economic resources. Yeah. So I need to care sacrificially and open up my wallet and be a part of the solution. And yet I feel like the number of immigrants is draining my wallet. And so there's that tension there of how do we believe in law and order and yet somehow care for those who don't have documents. They're, you know, the analogy for many of us is like if we park legally somewhere and we feed the meter and it expires. You know, many of the undocumented immigrants were documented at one time, but it expired, and they don't have a path to get back to legal citizenship, not just citizenship, but legal status today.
Yes.
And so there's that tension on the legal side. There's a tension on the economic side that we definitely feel.
How I don't know if you have a measure of this from the data you collected, but how well versed do you think respondents to your study are in all of the complexities of immigration law and how the immigration system works? And I'm asking that question because it kind of points to where are evangelical Christians learning about immigration. We never talked about this at church when I was growing up. So I'm curious, is it something that's talked about at church now? Or are they getting most of their information through the news or politicians? Was there anything in the study that could kind of point to answers to those questions?
Yeah. At most complicated issues, we all tend to simplify, but we did ask them where, you know, who's influencing their thinking. And we asked for the top three influencers. And friends and family are top of the list. And the Bible actually comes in as the second most frequently mentioned. And then immigrants that they've observed would be the third.
Interesting.
So media does make the list at number four. Politicians are further down the list. So you think that they're just following the candidate they support, whatever they're saying, and just 28%. Mentioned that. The Bible comes in quite a bit higher on the list than their local church. 22% mentioned their local church as being influential in their thinking. 31%, though, in another question, did say that their church had encouraged their congregation to reach out to immigrants in their community evangelistically.
Yeah. Is there another data point that I don't know if you found or asked about is how much personal interaction do respondents have with immigrants in their everyday lives, in their communities?
We didn't capture just kind of a volume of mm-hmm. everyday interactions, but a couple of questions kind of point to some experience they have. One is 19% of evangelicals are either a first or second generation immigrant themselves. So either they were born outside the United States or one or both of their parents were born outside the United States. So that's a lot of experience for, again, a pretty sizable minority of evangelicals. Yeah. And half of them said that their church has at least some first generation immigrants. So there's at least somebody in their church that, hey, I know their story. I know that they weren't born here. And I can relate to at least their story, even though it may not be representative of everything we're hearing about. Go ahead.
I was going to say, so that 77% who said that immigrants are a drain on the economy of the United States, it seems like a fairly big, you know, here's the economy. That's a big thing, right? I wonder how many of those people would also say that immigration has harmed them economically on a personal level or on a family or community level.
So 50% are saying they're a drain on resources. And even though many of them are going to be among those who have personal experiences with immigration and it's close to them, either in their own family or somebody they know. And, you know, some of that is the disconnect between, you know, legal paths toward immigration and the influx we saw, especially literally the month before this survey. We were setting records in December of the number of border crossings. And so as the media was covering that, I mean, sometimes you can get cynical and think the media is trying to create a story. And in that case, no, it was a real story. The numbers were there. That this was unprecedented. It had not happened before in that volume. So when we're asking about the number of immigrants, they're like, wow, even though we're a nation that, you know, really has absorbed huge numbers of immigrants throughout our history, we're good at that. This is actually a level we probably can't sustain, I think, was the message from people.
Yeah.
And so in the other questions, we see that, you know, especially as Christians, we should be caring, you know, especially for refugees. And you mentioned people may not always know what refugee means, but, mm-hmm. you know, that's somebody that's enduring persecution. It's not just somebody who's, you know, financially not in a good spot. Yes, there are definitely people who come to our border who want an opportunity financially. But a refugee, if you qualify as a refugee, you know, that's somebody who's being religiously persecuted, or
right.
politically persecuted,
yeah.
Or not just a war in their country, but it's a genocide, or, you know, it's those kinds of things that qualify you as a refugee. For us to be willing to care sacrificially for those that are in really dire straits like that, is something that people have, but there's also the tension of how much of this can we afford?
Right. So, was there anything in the report that surprised you?
It really goes back to the question on influences. The Bible, is really an influence that, I mentioned the top three, but if we go to which one did they pick first, mm-hmm. The Bible is actually at the top of that list.
Yeah.
So 26% picked the Bible as the top, and that has inched up as we've done these surveys through the years. It started out at 12%, and so
wow.
that doesn't happen very often.
Yeah.
You know, we've asked about a few other social issues, and the Bible and the church tends to be way down the list.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people are very much influenced by their family and friends, the conversations they grew up with. That's their perspective on our society. And, you know, on immigration, I mean, the Bible talks about it very directly, numerous times. It's close to God's heart. And it's still just a quarter, but, you know, that's the largest one group. Pointing to an influence.
Well, Scott McConnell is executive director of Lifeway Research in Nashville, Tennessee. In the show notes, we'll post a link to their latest study on evangelical Christian attitudes on immigration in the United States. It's very interesting. Go check it out. And Scott, thank you for bringing the data and telling us what it might mean.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure to have you.
There's a 3-month state of emergency right now in Turkey. So relief just around the clock. From what I hear, it's a tiring, exhausting pace that they're keeping up.
What kinds of things are they doing right now? What seems to be the most urgent task at hand for them?
Well, from what I hear from my sources, so I'm talking to people at the First Hope Association, which is a faith-based institution in Turkey that does first responding and aid, and then the Antalya Bible Church. The main needs that they have at the moment are hygiene-related or shelter.
That's a clip of the Christian Chronicle's Audrey Jackson way back in March 2023 in episode 9 of this show. She was reporting on the aftermath of the 7.8 Richter earthquake that devastated northern Syria and Turkey on February 6, 2023. What we know now, 1 year later, is that 50,000 people died in that earthquake and its aftershocks, and hundreds of thousands of people are still homeless. It's no wonder the earthquake toppled 850,000 buildings. Adding to the humanitarian crisis is the fact that about 1.8 million refugees of the Syrian civil war were staying in the region where the earthquake did the most damage. Well, a year ago, Audrey reported on the courageous and heroic efforts by Christians and congregations to help each other and help their neighbors in Turkey. She recently spent a few days on the ground in Turkey, following up with those brothers and sisters to see how they are doing now and what they still might need. She's back, and I think just about over her jet lag. Audrey, welcome home.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
All right. So, Audrey, you didn't go to Turkey right after the earthquakes struck a year ago, did you? I don't remember.
No, I didn't.
Okay. But you did interview a lot of people over in Turkey as they tried to recover from the disaster, and help a lot of their neighbors too. So, did you go back and meet some of those people in person this time when you were actually in the country? And what did they tell you about how things have progressed from a year ago?
Yeah, I did. I actually, except for one person, I got to meet just about everyone I spoke to when the earthquakes initially caused devastation in Turkey. And it was really interesting following up for the first time in person, even though we had built a rapport a year earlier and I'd kind of followed up with them in the months after, just checking in, making sure there hadn't been any major developments and seeing how the church was doing then. So it was good to catch up on the ground in person and actually get to see both the people face to face and the locations.
Yeah. So how have things progressed for them? At the time that we interviewed you a little over a year ago, they're very much in triage mode. Right. It was just from minute to minute trying to figure out who needed what and trying to keep people alive. So a year later, where do things stand with them?
Right. So I think my original article focused a lot on the Antalya Evangelical Church and the work they were doing. And they ended up taking in 25 people total because they actually had dorms already built into their church and they were able to house people. A lot of those people have since returned to the affected regions that they were displaced from because that's home for them and that's where they want to be. But the church has kept up with a lot of those connections. So even some of the ministers that I was with were going to visit the following week after I left some of the people that they had housed during that time. They were flying over to the different parts of Turkey to see them and follow up on those connections. And right now, I think there's still a lot of recovery. They've turned less so immediate needs and they're focused more on mental health. So they talked a lot about how a lot of the ministers and even members of the church are taking part in seminars about trauma and mental health and how to be a counselor and a support system.
Yeah.
Because there's a stigma around mental health in Turkey. And a lot of times it's encouraged just to be strong and have faith and not show pain and weakness. And so they're trying to encourage a more gentle and accepting area for people.
And how's that going?
I think it's going pretty well. They talked a lot about how while they were housing people, every evening was almost like a therapy group. People would come out of their rooms and sit around and share stories of things they'd lost, people they'd lost, things they'd heard and seen. And, you know, they just talked about it was kind of like this weeping, wailing fest almost every evening of people processing their shared trauma together and the ministers trying to support them the best they could.
Yeah. One of the things I remember from when we talked about this last year is Turkey is a nation of 99% Muslims. I mean, so 99%, I think, of everybody who lives there is Muslim. And one of the silver linings that you identified a year ago for the church there was that this would give them an opportunity to love their neighbors and reach out to their neighbors and be witnesses for Christ. How has this changed the relationship between the Christians there in Turkey and their Muslim neighbors? Do they feel like they've made some progress there?
One of the things I heard from multiple people while I was there was this has helped the reputation of the church, because a lot of times Christians are very much looked at as kind of outside agents, whether they're Turkish Christians or they are foreigners who have come in, but they're seen almost as agents of Western civilization.
Yeah.
And so people don't tend to want to listen to them or interact with them. They find them, you know, scary. There's tons of conspiracy theories about why they're there and what they're trying to do. But giving aid really kind of opened the door for them to improve on that reputation and show that they really are just people of faith who are trying to help their neighbors and reach out. And it was really interesting talking to one of the ministers in Antalya, because he talked about how since it was Eastern Turkey that was mostly devastated by the earthquake, that's a place that has been historically not very open to the gospel. And this opened doors that they had never had before because they were going into areas and handing out relief items. And so they were able to naturally strike up conversations that they wouldn't have been able to have otherwise.
So a year ago, you saw pictures of the destruction and you posted those in your story. I don't remember where you got them, but you didn't take them yourself. This time though, you took the photographs. So you were there and you saw with your own eyes, the aftermath of this earthquake. Can you attempt to describe, what it was like for you to be there?
I could try.
Go for it.
I think it was interesting driving in. Turkey's a lot more mountainous than I expected it to be. And so when you're driving in specifically to Antakya, which was one of the cities the most devastated, 80% of their structures are deemed unsound and either were destroyed or are slated for demolishment. When you're driving in, you're coming over these mountains into this giant valley. And everything seems really normal until you start getting into the city limits. And then you start noticing that there is cracks. Do I need to hush him?
No, we love it when we have dogs on the show.
Okay. I started noticing, you know, you pass these two-story structures when you're starting to come into town. And you're noticing there are cracks. You're seeing some of the earthquake damage. But then you get into kind of the city center where the residential areas would have been. So you have more high rises, 7-8 stories, and it's just open fields because those buildings are gone and they're either torn down in piles or they're standing there with cracks running up the side of them.
Wow.
Or it's just a scraped field of mud and concrete that you can walk across. But there aren't roads and neighborhoods anymore because they've just been completely brought down.
Are there people still living there, or is it a ghost town?
Not in those areas. So the people are essentially living around the city limits now. And there are container housings, temporary communities. So First Hope Association, a lot of what they've pivoted to is putting up temporary container housing. And then there are tent camps. And kind of the difference between the two are Turkish citizens and legal refugees can live in the temporary container housing. They can qualify. And illegal immigrants from, say, Syria, refugees who are escaping the war, who came across the border illegally because it's very close to the border of Syria, they don't qualify for that aid. So they have had to move into tent camps.
Now, is Antakya, is that the ancient biblical city of Antioch?
It is.
Okay, so there's a connection to the Bible there. And I think I read somewhere that the normal population of Antakya is something like, I don't know, 1.7 million. Mm-hmm. And there are like maybe 250,000 people left in the city because of how heavily destroyed it was. That's what I read. Was that your experience on the ground?
I think it would be hard to equate numbers just going from community to community. I'm not sure if that's how it is. I know a lot of people initially left and were displaced into other cities and provinces. But from what I've heard, a lot of them are trying to come back, trying to come home, yeah, or what is left of home in these container homes and temporary housing.
So what left the deepest impression on you from your trip over there?
I think it's always just the people that get to me, the hospitality. So in the tent camps, one of the Syrian refugees welcomed us into his family's tent. Even though we were just foreigners, strangers there to distribute aid, he wanted to welcome us into his home. And then in the container housing, there was a woman who made us all tea. We were there for 10 minutes, but she made sure we all had a steaming hot cup of tea and tried to talk to us the best she could through a translator.
Wow. So a year ago, we were able to post some ways for people to help if they wanted to come alongside their brothers and sisters and neighbors there in Turkey and the Syrian refugees that are living there as well. How can people help now if they want to?
So First Hope Association, it's a faith-based organization that's a nonprofit in Turkey. They're providing a lot of the container homes and they're still building more for people who are displaced. And they're supported by One Kingdom, which is a ministry of Whites Ferry Road Church of Christ. And they're all accepting donations at this time.
We will post links to those in the show notes. Audrey Jackson of the Christian Chronicle is all in on reporting the news from Christians around the world, even Christians in a disaster zone. Many thanks to her for going to Turkey to bring you back a report from your brothers and sisters there. If God moves you, please do what you can to come alongside them. Click on one of those links that we post in the show notes. And we'll also have a link to Audrey's newest story and all those photos that she took from Turkey. Audrey, thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
Our final guests today gave college basketball fans one of the best endings to a game that they'll ever see in their lives. And it wasn't just any game. It was the National Association of Intercollegiate Athletics Men's Basketball National Championship game on March 26 in Kansas City, Missouri. And here is how it went down. After grinding through a 16-team tournament to get to the national title game, our guests were underdogs to Langston University, which lost only two games in its entire 37-game season. Our guests trailed by as many as 12 points in the second half, and with less than a minute to play, they were still down by 6 points. Now, listener, I'm not going to hide the truth from you. My wife knows that when my team is down by that many points with that little time left in the game, I've got to leave the room and take a walk outside because I can't take it. But our guests could not leave because they were in the game and they had to play it out. And they rose to the occasion. They played harder than they played in all 36 games that came before this one. Using a smothering full court defense and turning up the hustle, they scored 10 unanswered points to come back and shock the world for the win. They brought home to their school its first men's intercollegiate national championship in its 116-year history. They are the Lions of Freed Hardeman University in Henderson, Tennessee. It's a school with deep roots and strong ties in the Church of Christ. And they are NAIA national champions. Today, we have with us Coach Drew Stutz, who also won NAIA Coach of the Year, and team captains sophomore Peyton Law and junior Geraldo Lane. And they're joined by junior Riley McLaren. Congratulations on winning it all.
Thank you. We appreciate you having us.
All right. So as we're recording this, it's been a little over 2 weeks now since that magical night in Kansas City. What feelings and memories seem to be the ones that are sticking with you?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is when Peyton dribbled the ball out and the confetti went off and everything. That the feeling right there was the best feeling ever. And I've never experienced anything close to that level of excitement. So that was just unmatched.
What did you do, Geraldo, in that? Do you remember what you were doing when the confetti started to come down and the clock expired?
It was a lot of running, jumping, and screaming.
Right on.
Just looking back at the photos and all the people that were there, I mean, we had probably hundreds of people from Henderson travel, and that was really cool just because of just the location we're at and us being, what, 5.5 hours away or probably more than that, 7 or 8, and just having them support and then having our families there to enjoy that moment with us was huge. And it also gave us a huge advantage playing as well, having those people behind our bench. So just looking back and knowing that we had a really good support system through that and then just having fun with our families all week too was really cool.
I would say just that whole week down there, you know, it was a lot of fun with the guys, not even just on the court, but just have that experience of knowing that we're playing for that big of a game. It was amazing to do that with great guys.
Had any of you ever played in high school, junior high, college, anywhere else? Had any of you ever played in a championship game before?
I played in a football state championship game.
Okay.
I lost.
So what does it feel like? What does it feel like then to be in a championship game? Not just any championship game, but the national championship game.
I feel like it's, you know, it's kind of unreal because as a little kid, like growing up playing sports, you always dream of being a national champion of wherever you go, yeah. Whatever team you want to play for. That's every team's goal. And to know that you're a player on that team playing for a national championship, it's a dream come true.
Every team talks about, you know, winning a national championship, being a national champion, but how often does that really happen? I mean, Coach Stutz asked us, you know, going into those big games, it was like, how many people do you personally know that's a national champion? Yep. And we all just kind of looked at each other. It was like, I don't think we know anybody. But so it feels good just winning that with people who I consider family.
You know somebody now, don't you? You know a lot of people now.
You know a lot of people now.
Including the man in the mirror.
Obviously, winning the national championship is just an incredible experience all the way around. It's one of those things, like they said, you hope and you dream of. But I think really, you know, the fashion in which we won the game was really exciting. We came from behind with less than a minute to go to win the game. And so, you know, how it happened was a lot of fun. But probably even more so who we did it with. You know, this group of guys, it's easy to find talent, but it's not easy to find talent that are perfect fits together. And I feel like over the last 3 or 4 years, we've done a great job of identifying, you know, a certain type of person, not just a certain type of player. And just like Geraldo just said, I mean, this group was truly a family. It wasn't just a bunch of basketball players. You know, maybe as they came in, they thought they were just going to be a bunch of basketball players playing ball together. But the friendships and doing it with the quality people that we've done it with, I really think that's what makes it special. I know winning is special, but to do it with guys that I plan on being friends with the rest of my life, and for those guys to experience it, just an unbelievable experience.
Yeah, I've got a question for my own curiosity. I didn't plan on asking this, but I was never an athlete. And so when you play in a championship game like y'all did, I've heard athletes say we're treating it like any other game, right? But when you step out on that court, you know, to warm up and get ready to actually play the game, does it feel different, or are you able to make it just about playing another game? I mean, what does it feel like as you're getting ready to play for that championship?
I think from a coach's standpoint, you know, I tried to be sure those guys just stay true to who they were. I think a lot of times you can go into that game, and sometimes as a fan, you're a little more nervous than when you're a coach or a player. You know, it may be leading up to the game. There might be a little bit more nerves and those sorts of thoughts. But honestly, once those first 2 minutes of the game get rolling, you're just in the mode of just playing and competing. I don't think, you know, a lot of people have asked, well, you know, what's going through your head the last minute of the game, you know, and really it's just winning the next play, and it's just doing the things that you've done all year. And I know that may sound cliche, and that may sound like a boring answer, but it's just the truth.
I want to ask you about this, coach. I think in some of the interviews that you gave after the game, you talked about being tough. And I think I heard you say something like the toughest team would win the title game, and y'all proved to be the toughest team, but you didn't just turn that toughness on in the final minute of the season. You had to plant that seed somewhere way back early in the season and then cultivate it all season long. So if you look back on the season, maybe going all the way back to, you know, training camp or whatever, can you pinpoint some specific moments where you think you planted those seeds of toughness and cultivated them so that you were ready when that moment came in the title game?
A lot of preparation, a lot of time has went into being prepared for those moments. And honestly, I would go all the way back to maybe 3 years ago. We lost in the conference tournament to Georgetown. We've also lost to Thomas More a year before that in the conference tournament. And I remember, you know, at that moment thinking through, you know, what are the things we've got to do to get to the next step and be a better team. You know, I think we've been talented in the past, but I don't think we've had the level of toughness that this team has. And, you know, it's one of those things where you hold these guys accountable in their day-to-day approach to weightlifting or, you know, skill work or team practices. And obviously the preseason, there's some things that we do where we really challenge them mentally and physically and push them way beyond what they think their body might be capable of. And I think those things, along with accountability, you know, I think right now in athletics, there's not a lot of accountability at times. There's a lot of telling kids what they want to hear so you can attract the right talent and keep guys around. But I think accountability is where you develop toughness, you know, holding people accountable to the standards that they've set and that you've set for your program. I think when you're consistently doing that, it builds a level of toughness that a lot of teams don't have right now.
It first started whenever we first got here on campus. We have a week dedicated, and it's called Tough Week. Huh. Every day is a different type of challenge for you. You got sprints, hill sprints, weightlifting, all different kinds of stuff. And that really where it starts out. And going through that with the guys and holding each other accountable, like Coach said, you know, it's different from the coach holding you accountable. But whenever the players are holding each other accountable, that's how you know you've created a bond with each other and you're wanting to win.
I think it also brings us closer together as a team because we're all doing and going through the same thing. I mean, if I'm struggling, I'm pretty sure Peyton and Riley struggling as well. And so it kind of just brings you together. And yes, we hold each other accountable, but we also pick each other up as well to help each other through those tough times. And we think that also something that translates into the games when somebody is struggling.
Yeah, I think at times our practices are tougher than games.
Wow.
So I think when you have that, you know, from your coaches putting you through those challenges during practice and testing you in practice, you get in a game situation and it comes natural. You know, you have adversity in the game, but you've been testing in practice. So you're training your mind and your body to respond to those challenges in practice. You get in a game and it just flows, you know. So I think being in the position that our coaches put us in through practice, it allows us to be really, really tough on the court. And like Coach said, the tougher team wins, and we proved that all year.
What was the lowest point of your season? You had a winning season. It was a good year, but I figure any championship team has to hit a point where they have to push through a challenge, or, you know, the doldrums or something like that, the drudgery of just practicing day in and day out. What would you say was the toughest point or the hardest point of the season for y'all?
Yeah, I think, like, collectively as a team, I can't think of one thing really. And that's a product of all of us being together. Like, we didn't allow one thing to really hold us back.
Wow.
Because we had 19 other guys there for us. And me personally, I had back problems in the beginning of the year. So I feel like we have guys that can relate to that question more personally than as a team. Mm-hmm. So for me, I have back problems, and that was a challenge in itself. But because of the group of guys that we have around us, it didn't hinder me from being an asset in some way to the team.
When we first started practice this year, we had quite a few new players on our team. We had lost a group of guys, 6-7 seniors off last year's team. And I think, the guys that were returners knew kind of what the standard was as far as what practice and day-to-day things look like. And those first 2 or 3 weeks of practice were a struggle, trying to get new guys caught up to speed. And there was kind of a standard that the returners had and the standard of the new guys, and trying to bridge that gap and get those guys up to speed. I think for a lot of our guys, that was a challenge because they were ready to take off and go 110%, but we had to kind of lead those guys up to where we needed to go. So just thinking back, that was probably the toughest part, was just getting the wheels turning like we needed them to.
Mm. Was there a point during the season where you really felt like the team just became cohesive? You brought in a lot of new people that had to learn the program and they had to get to know you. You know, is there a point where you're like, yeah, we're together now?
I don't think so. Honestly, I would love to point to a certain moment and say, yeah, but I mean, we consistently play 10 guys, and throughout the course of the year, different guys stepped up at different times. We had 9 different leading scorers out of those 10 guys throughout the year. And even in the national tournament game, we had 5 different leading scorers in 6 games. And so I think guys were just ready for their moment. There wasn't really a peak like, you know, man, we're firing on all cylinders, you know, every single person. Guys were just ready for the moment and their opportunity, and did a good job just playing together throughout the course of the year.
Let me ask you this, Coach. You mentioned something about accountability a moment ago, and, you know, everybody knows college sports is changing a lot these days. And so, you know, if you were just about winning and nothing else, it'd be hard enough to recruit, you know, really talented basketball players who could help you win and then keep them at your program. But you have the added challenge of recruiting men of character who have a Christian orientation, and then keeping them with your program. Does that add a couple of extra layers of challenge for you as a basketball coach to find those players, get them on your team, and then beat the teams that are really all about winning? You know, yeah. Forget about character and accountability. Let's just win. How do you overcome that challenge?
I think sometimes people get the talent ahead of the character, and people are more drawn to those guys that have had success on the floor. And I think there's a certain steps that you have to take to become a champion. You know, you can have a lot of success with a lot of talented guys, but to build a consistent winning program, you got to have guys that want to be at your university, that want to be part of a program that has the standards and the accountability and the toughness that we set. And so sometimes, you know, I think some people can look at that and say, man, that's a obstacle or that's a challenge. And in some ways it would be for the wrong coach or the wrong program. But I think for us, it really just complements what we're all about to begin with. And that's why, you know, I feel like I'm a good fit for Freed Harbin University, and we've had the success that we've had here because, you know, those are the things that really matter to me. I think you try to figure out who first, you know, establish what type of person you're looking for. Then you can figure out the what as time goes on. But I know if you give me guys that, you know, have some athletic basketball ability, but at the same time are high character guys that are going to be great teammates, that are going to be good students in the classroom, that are going to be good representatives of the university. I think if you put all those things together, you're destined for success. And, you know, it's up to me at that point to figure out how to put those pieces together and figure out how to win on the floor. But, you know, one thing I know I need to be short here, but one thing I'll say is, you know, we're trying to build a program here. We're not trying to build a team. And I think at the college level, a lot of times right now, people are trying to put teams together in individual years where, you know, 90%+ of our team right now have been program guys that have come here as, you know, high school seniors and have put in the time and work. And, you know, it's kind of an old school way of going about doing things right now, but it's been really good for us. And, you know, I think guys like Riley and Geraldo and Peyton, those guys have come here from high school. And it's meaningful, you know, it's very fulfilling to come here and put in that work and grow with that certain group of guys and to reach championship level basketball. It's different, but I think it separates us in a good way.
And that trophy is proof that it's working. So last question for y'all, you know, it's a familiar sight to see athletes who win big games, you know, point their fingers at the sky and give glory to God. And I think I read in a news story, Coach, that you were quoted as giving glory to God for your big win. How do y'all think that something like winning a college basketball championship glorifies God? Or maybe I should ask, how do you hope that your win will glorify God?
Well, I hope it's the way we do it. We try to do it the right way with, you know, surrounding ourselves with people that are like-minded and are good people to start off. Before you can do anything, you don't have the right people in place to do it. And coming from a faith-based background, family, is refreshing to come into the program as a freshman and be held accountable and to a standard at which you were at home. And I feel like that's rare to be a part of a program in that way. And it starts with Coach Stutz just holding us to that standard and honoring God in everything we do and realizing that without him, like, we wouldn't be able to have the talents to compete for a championship.
I think it all starts with, you know, the school of the school Freed Harbin and to the head coach, Coach Stutz, you know, just being able to understand that God is the source of everything that we have. And without him, we wouldn't be able to do any of this. And so winning that national championship, I look at it as a way of him just, I'm not going to say rewarding us, but because I mean, we worked for it, but of good things happening to good people because we did it the right way. Yeah. And that's just how I look at it.
I'd say all of us coming in, it starts as high school senior. God had a reason for us to all end up here. And for us, all of us to have that faith in us and all work together, it was really great to do that with a group of guys. And one thing that kind of stood out to a lot of other people was whenever we were there in Kansas City, we had our own Sunday service in the hotel. You know, they were saying, yeah, this national championship is like the biggest thing right now, but you wouldn't be here if it wasn't for God. So all of that goes to him.
When you accomplish something great like this, you naturally think how and why is this happening to me? You know, like what have we done to earn this? What's different about us? And I don't think there really is anything particularly different. You know, I've said throughout the tournament, I don't know that I'm the best coach. I don't know that we have the best talent. But because of the school here and the environment that they've cultivated, and, you know, that goes from professors to our secretary here in the office to our athletic director to our president, the way they lead, the way that these guys are taught day in and day out from not just me, but so many people here on campus, this is a special place. And, you know, we're a God-centered University. And it's beautiful just to see, like Riley said, us doing things the right way and for us to wind up on top. You know, it's definitely a blessing and something that was not done by ourselves.
Well, congratulations again to Coach Drew Stutz and three of his players here, Peyton Law, Riley McLaren, and Geraldo Lane, as well as the entire Freed Hardeman University men's basketball program for capturing their school's first ever men's national championship. It's been 116 years in the making, and now your names are etched in history. So congratulations to you all.
Thank you. We appreciate you having us.
It's been a pleasure. This episode is now etched in history, too. We hope you enjoyed it. Thank you for listening to our guests today, and thank you to our guests. Scott McConnell joined us from Lifeway Research. The Christian Chronicle's own Audrey Jackson shook off her jet lag to report on her trip to Turkey, and we heard from Coach Drew Stutz and three of his players, Geraldo Lane, Peyton Law, and Riley McLaren, from the 2024 NAIA Men's Basketball National Champion Freed Hardeman University Lions. We pray that God blessed you through what you heard today. If you received that blessing and you want to pass it on, please pray for this ministry and do us a favor or two. Subscribe to this podcast and then share it with a friend. Recommend and review it on whatever podcast service you use. And send us your comments, ideas, and suggestions at podcast@christianchronicle.org. And if you feel fuller or richer because of something you heard today, please pay it forward. Make a tax-deductible gift to the Christian Chronicle. Just click on the link in the show notes or go to christianchronicle.org/donate to make your gift now. Until next time, may grace and peace be yours in abundance.
The Christian Chronicle podcast is a production of the Christian Chronicle Incorporated, informing and inspiring Church of Christ congregations and members around the world since 1943. The Christian Chronicle's associate editor is Audrey Jackson, editor-in-chief Bobby Ross Jr., and president and CEO Eric Trigestad. The Christian Chronicle podcast is produced, written, directed, and hosted by B.T. Irwin and is recorded, edited, and engineered by James Flanagan at Podcast Your Voice Studios in Southfield, Michigan, Detroit, USA.